Today we're talking about the dark side of healthcare that nobody really wants to talk about. So what if I told you that one of the biggest threats to your health is not your illness? It's navigating a healthcare system that even healthcare professionals struggle to survive. And today we're pulling back the curtain and exposing some truth. So most of us trust the healthcare system without ever seeing what happens behind the scenes. But today's guest definitely has. Jenny White has spent more than 30 years as a registered nurse working in intensive care, trauma, emergency medicine, public health, and long-term care. She witnessed humanity at the absolute best and sometimes at its worst. Then, after dedicating her life to caring for others, everything changed when she became the patient herself after being diagnosed with a life-threatening brain tumor. So this experience gave her something very few people have: the perspective of someone who's lived on both sides of the hospital bed. So today we're talking about the conversations hospitals rarely have with the public, the hidden realities of modern healthcare, how patients can become their own best advocates, what families need to know before a medical crisis happens, and why understanding the system could one day save your life. This isn't about creating fear. It's about giving you knowledge that could make all the difference when it matters the most. And so, Jenny, it's so good to see you again. We were just talking about what's going on in your life, and there's a lot of exciting things happening. Thanks so much for being here today.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to have this conversation. Man, after more than 3 decades in healthcare, what would you say some of the biggest misconceptions the public has about hospitals?
Sure. Well, there's lots of things that people don't see as they walk through the door, and some things that they do see. Where can we start? Let's start with staffing as an example. So some of the challenges with staffing are not having enough appropriately educated staff available at any one time. One of the things that's happening today in healthcare, certainly in Canada, and I think around the world, is that some of the things that registered nurses, as an example, used to do are now being downloaded onto less qualified staff. And what that means is that the person who is providing you with a service or a test or a medicine or procedure may or may not originally have been qualified to give you that procedure. Hospitals are tending to do is they're downloading them onto staff who are less experienced, less educated, and as a result, that puts everybody at risk. Now, a perfect example might be, I know in Ontario that registered nurses always used to be the ones to run IVs and to give medications and that kind of thing. And in some settings, what they're doing is they're eliminating the role of the RN traditionally and making her a manager overseeing a group of staff underneath her. So she's no longer, even though she's still responsible, he or she may not be delivering the direct service, but really overseeing other staff. And in some environments, such as in nursing homes or in rehab facilities and that kind of thing, it's an RPN, like a registered practical nurse, that does not have the same in-depth knowledge and understanding that a registered nurse would have. And they're now responsible for handing out medications. And in some cases, it's even a personal support worker. And the difference is, it's not just about giving a pill. It's about understanding what the drug is, what it does, what could go wrong with that particular medication, and knowing to see it and do something about it. So that's just one example of what might be happening. Budgets can be tight. And having been a director of care, I know what it's like to juggle your money against what you need to provide as service. And so, unfortunately, the pressure is there to work within the budget, but sometimes that does put the patient at risk.
Yeah, there's all these things behind the scenes that we're not seeing. And you're talking about staffing. I know how frustrating it is when, you're talking to someone in the hospital and you're wanting answers and they're telling you that they're not qualified to give you those answers and you have to wait for the next person and the next person. And yeah, it can be really challenging, especially when, people who are going to the hospital aren't feeling well and they're looking for answers and it's very high stress. What about, is there anything is there something that every patient assumes is happening behind the scenes that simply isn't?
Well, I think patients get very frustrated, certainly with things like wait times. When you're sitting in a waiting room and you're not feeling well and you have to wait for hours and hours and hours to be seen, I think people need to understand that there are real restraints on the system. And so staff, when they first assess you, they have to decide who should be seen first based on their presenting illness. And even though you feel particularly lousy and you want to be seen right away, the reality is there's probably 10 people before you that are more critically ill that have to be taken into account first. And so people don't necessarily understand the process. Now, for myself, I've been in that position where, you know, you walk into the emergency department because you know something serious is happening. So, you know, a couple of things you can do. When you go up to the counter to be seen by a nurse first, they usually do what's called a triage. What's your complaint? Why are you here? Okay, go take a seat. One thing you can do as a patient is advocate for yourself. You can be, you know, don't make things up, but be very clear about why you're so concerned. For example, I went into the hospital after I had my brain surgery, and I knew something was going on because I, you know, the nurse inside of me knew there was something happening, but you couldn't necessarily see it. So I walked into the emerge department, took my little ticket off the thing, and it said, you know, you're number 39, and there were 38 other people in front of me. And it was like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to make it. So I walked up to the window and I said, look, here's what's happened. I had surgery on this date. I was told if I experienced these things, I needed to come in right away. And so you basically provide the information that they need to make a better decision.
That's so important. I was going to ask you about self-advocacy. People sometimes give all of their power away to someone who's wearing a white coat. And, you know, we need to really understand what's going on. And if we're feeling a certain way, we can't assume that the person in the white coat knows everything. And so I think what you said about being so transparent and really having them hear you is really important. And if they're not hearing you, then I would go to somebody else and, you know, try and have your concerns heard.
Yeah, there is a saying, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the oil. And if you truly feel that you are in danger or that you need to be seen right away, you need to make that very, very clear. One of the other things you need to understand is there's usually one or two physicians working in an emergency department, and they're there because that's their scheduled shift. And they literally are handed chart after chart after chart to go and do a quick review with a patient that's been brought in. And so you really almost need to have your little speech ready, you know. Give them the information they need to make a decision. And you can demand things. You can say, look, I think I'm having a stroke. I want a CT scan. I want an MRI. Now, in Canada, we don't have to pay for that because that's part of our healthcare system. But it might be the difference between being diagnosed correctly or being sent home saying, no, you're fine, go away, only to have a bad result later on. So be informed, use your voice. You don't have to be mean about it. Just be firm and assertive and say, this is why I'm concerned. This is what I would like to have happen. And if you're showing symptoms, then they're going to take you seriously.
Absolutely. Are there certain questions that patients or family members should be asking their healthcare team, like specific ones?
Well, yes. I mean, depending on the circumstance, you can always ask for a second opinion. But if you've walked into an emergency department, you're probably there for a very valid reason. The other thing to consider, too, is maybe the emergency department is not the right place for you. If there's a clinic you can go to, like a walk-in clinic in your neighborhood, that would be better for smaller items. Like, I think I have an infection or, you know, I've got a stomach ache, those kinds of things. Whereas in an emergency department, they really want to deal with the most critically ill first. So you're just going to end up waiting a long time. So it's okay to ask questions. In fact, it's better if you ask questions. You know, are there other things that we can be doing, or what should I be doing? Or, you know, are there tests that I should have? Those kinds of things. And so many people have phones with them now that they can quickly look up online. What do you think this is? You know, what tests should follow, and just ask. Now, one thing that I want to share with people is that we sometimes forget that when we go into hospital as a patient, that, you know, the world revolves around us, and that's not the way it works at all. So every moment of every day, nurses, doctors, tests, people who do like your x-rays and your CT scans and all of those kinds of things have priorities. And it's not just sick people. It's, you know, they may have online conferences they have to attend that they just can't get out of. Like it's designated as part of their training or part of their consulting or whatever. And so that sometimes causes delays. But the other thing to know is that all staff are human, and they have good days and they have bad days. And if they're feeling stressed, they can be short. They can be what appears to be rude. They can just be struggling of trying to get through their shift. So you have to remember too that, you know, there's a lot of violence in the workplace. And when people feel threatened by someone challenging them or asking for more than what they feel they can give, they kind of get their backs up. And when they get their backs up, they tend to, file you in with, oh my goodness, she's back again. She's giving me a hard time. And so they stop listening to you and they start reacting to you. And what you want as a patient is to be heard, heard politely, heard with you talking to them in an assertive way, but not a mean or threatening or nasty way. You get a lot farther that way.
Absolutely. I was just going to ask you about the human side of healthcare. I mean, nurses and physicians, they carry an enormous emotional burden, not only because they're dealing with their own lives, but they're dealing with really, really sick people who are going through incredibly life-altering situations. And especially if you're an empath, you know, and you're holding on to all of that. What is some things that most people don't see in terms of the human side of nurses and physicians?
Well, one thing that they don't see is that often these guys are working overtime. They're picking up extra shifts to make sure that, you know, a department is covered. And, you know, that all takes a toll because you're constantly working tired. You're constantly working stressed. You're being removed from your own family and, you know, they're missing family events. And it is incredibly hard for them. And when they're not treated professionally, I mean, that's unkind. It's just unkind. These guys are highly qualified. They work hard to get to where they are. They're well-trained and they're intuitive. And they need to be treated respectfully and they need to be treated with respect from the organization and not just from patients.
Absolutely. Do you have a patient story that... like perhaps someone that you've never forgotten?
Oh gosh, there's been so many over the years. You know, your goal as a nurse is to help people, help them in a crisis. And, you know, there's been many, many times where I've had to be the one to tell them that a loved one's died or that things have not gone well. And you feel for those people. You can feel their guts turning inside out. You feel the sadness and the shame and the frustration of not being able to have fixed the problem. And people react differently to grief. And some people become very quiet and withdrawn, and other people become very aggressive and angry. And, you know, as a nurse, I've been punched, I've been spit on, I've had things thrown at me, I've been, strangled. And it's just an unfortunate part of the job, but it's a part of the job that they need to do something about. You know, hospitals are posting signs and things saying, you know, no violence or aggressive behavior will be tolerated. And that's great, but that doesn't help you right in the minute when it's happening. So people need to understand that, you know, nurses and doctors and other medical staff come to work every day and are often abused. And that's unfortunate. And it causes burnout from staff. And it causes them to find other ways to practice their professions.
So you eventually became the patient. And how did becoming a patient completely change the way you view healthcare?
Well, it's kind of shocking in a way. I mean, I had had other kinds of surgeries that, you know, tend to happen as you age. And I have to say that my experience has always been pretty good. And now part of that is because when staff know that you're a healthcare professional or an EMS worker or something like that, you're automatically like family and they tend to take good care of you. But when you are a healthcare professional and you become the patient, first of all, you know too much. You know exactly what's going to happen to you. You know exactly what they're going to end up doing to you. And for me, I kind of had to just say, okay, yeah, I know you got to do it. Just do what you got to do and get me through this. But it's not a fun experience. I was an ICU nurse. And I remember when I was nursing in ICU, I remember thinking, oh my goodness, I hope I'm never a trauma on a Sunday night. Or I hope I never end up in an ICU. And the reason is, you don't want to be a trauma on a Sunday night because your poor surgeon on call has been up since Friday morning and probably hasn't slept yet. And it's now Sunday night. And you're in the next trauma coming in, and the poor guy is beyond sense, right? He's just walking on adrenaline, and you just don't want to be his patient at that time of the day. And that's not his fault. That's the way the system is designed. Being in an ICU is not fun. It's a noisy, busy, congested place. It's very active. You're not going to get any rest there unless you are in a coma. And there are things that happen in ICUs, which I sort of profiled in the book that, you know, people wouldn't think about until they became a patient in an ICU.
What are some of those things?
Well, again, things like exhausted staff working, things like super bugs that tend to be in hospitals and can easily be transmitted person to person through air or touch, people forgetting to wash their hands, not because they don't think it's important. It's because, you know, a crisis is happening. So they just jump in, you know, lots of things, lots of death all the time, which takes a toll on people and just risks that happen. Like I said, all staff are human and mistakes sometimes get made. And when you're dealing with exhausted staff, they can inadvertently and unintentionally make a calculation error in your medication. They can accidentally choose the wrong drug to give you because the names are almost identical. So there are things that happen. Yeah.
Yeah, that's scary, but true. That's why you need to have, you need to be an advocate for yourself, but your family can also contribute to that as well. Families often feel quite helpless in hospitals. Is there any advice you could give to families that they could do that maybe genuinely make a difference?
Well, you know, if they're present and they can ask questions, there's nothing wrong with that. And just ask in a nice way, can you explain to me about this? Or why would this be happening? Or is there anything that we can do as family members to support the patient? Because sometimes, you know, patients are very frightened and nurses do not have the time to stand at the bedside and comfort them. And that's a terrible thing to say because that used to be a huge component of what we did. But because of pressures, you know, you may be looking at a nurse who's got 40 patients that she's responsible for. And so she's got to make choices about who needs what when, who's in trouble, who needs a closer watch versus somebody who's doing well. And a lot of families want the nurse to be kind of the one-to-one caregiver. And that's just not the reality. They're spread thin, they're stressed, they're prioritizing, they're trying to do 20 different tasks at once. And so people need to be kind, they need to be patient, they need to speak up when they see something happening that doesn't seem right. It's okay to say, why is my mom getting this medication now? And ask and just make sure that everything is happening the way it should.
Yeah, that's great advice. Is there any mistakes that families make, not because they don't care or they're trying to be, you know, difficult or annoying, but because they simply don't know?
Always, always. Or they have misconceptions about what they think should be happening. And an example that I should bring forward is things like end-of-life care. It's really important for people to have those conversations with their family members about what their wishes are and what they are okay with and not okay with. Because what sometimes happens is that patients will come in at end of life for, and families push and push and push. No, you got to keep mom or dad alive. You got to keep them alive. I don't care what you have to do. If you have to, you know, put them on a ventilator, put them on a ventilator. And that may very much go against what the patient themselves want. So it's really important to have those conversations. And I know they're not great conversations to have around the dinner table, but I'll use myself as an example. When I found out I had a brain tumor, you know, the family gathered just prior to our surgery. And I had those conversations with them. And I said, look, guys, this is what I think is going to happen. I don't think I'm going to survive. Here's what I want you to do. And I even went so far as to write my own obituary to make sure that that was one piece they didn't have to deal with. And I'm a pretty practical girl. Like, I'm very black and white in terms of, you know, here are things that need to be dealt with. Let's deal with them. And other people are, oh, mom, don't talk about that. That's horrible. It's not really. It was clear to everybody what my wishes were. And I'm glad I had that conversation, because when I was in a coma, then my husband knew exactly what I was willing to do and not do. And an example is, I didn't want a feeding tube. Like, if I'm going to be ventilated long enough that they need to start feeding me, then let me go. And so the conversation came up. I think we should put a feeding tube into her. And it was like, no, she doesn't want that. So it didn't happen because I was clear. So I think even though they're uncomfortable conversations, it's part of life. You know, just like birth is part of life, death is part of life. And you might as well tell people what you're willing to do.
Remind people on your story. So you were in a coma. What happened? How did you come back to life? What was that like? Do you remember any of it?
Well, I do remember coming out of the coma. Yeah. So I was in a coma for about 4 days after I had brain surgery. And with brain surgery, you know, location is everything. So of course, my brain tumor would be in the worst place possible. So they had to dig for it. And they actually took away part of my skull. You can kind of see it here, where part of my skull is now removed because it kind of got destroyed as they were trying to get into my brain. And I also have like big lines of where sutures were. Anyway, when I came out of my coma, a couple of things became quite real to me. Well, first of all, I was so grateful to be alive because I really didn't expect to make it through the operation. So that was a good start. Then I realized I was tied to the bed, and that was not a good start. That was like, oh goodness. I knew as a nurse, having worked in an ICU, if you're tied to the bed, you're a bad girl. So what I was doing was, when I was coming out of my coma, I was ripping things off and trying to get at my my suture lines and that kind of thing. And they had to do what they had to do to stop me from hurting myself. Then I realized there was a man at the end of the bed in street clothes, and I hadn't a clue who he was. He was my husband of 20 years. We'd been together for 30, but married for 20. Hadn't a clue who he was. And when the nurses started asking me questions, you know, what's your name, whatever, I thought I was answering them totally appropriately. Turns out I was only making sound. Words weren't coming. It was just sound. And so once they explained to me, okay, you're not making any sense. Try to stay calm. You know, your speech center was clearly affected. I thought, goodness, I do have a serious problem here. And then they got me up to walk and I couldn't get my legs and feet to go where I wanted them to go. So I knew I had some serious challenges ahead and you just kind of have to accept, okay, well, at the moment, this is my new normal and let's just move on.
Wow, that's incredible. While you were in a coma, do you remember anything? Like they talk about out-of-body experiences. Did any of that happen to you?
I didn't have any out-of-body experiences, but I do remember a couple of things. I remember voices of some of the staff, and I could probably go back today and point to the person who was talking to me. And I've had that as a nurse as well, where people have come back to say thank you and have said, I know you. I recognize your voice. So I remembered that. And I remembered the feeling of being turned because they have to, you know, keep moving you in the bed to keep you from getting bed sores. And I remember feeling like a solid log just being moved around and not being able to do anything about it. So those are the two memories that I have.
Wow. Well, that's really good to know because quite often people are talking to a loved one who's, you know, in a coma and they're wondering if they can hear them. Right. And it's really comforting to know that, that you can, and you're still reaching that person, no matter if they're like coherent or not. So that's really interesting.
That's right.
So you now write these medical horror novels, which is super cool. And I mean, coming back after all of that and doing what you're doing and talking about, you know, you're going to be hosting a TV show. It's just so incredible. It's such an amazing story. How much of what readers think is fiction do you believe is actually inspired by real life experiences?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I think it really depends on who the author is. One of the things when I was kind of learning about writing books, because I'd never had any interest before this, you know, one of the things they teach you is use what you know to help you write. And so I knew I had 33 years of nursing experience and lots of stories and experiences, and I knew what it was like to be a brain tumor patient. So I put those two together and I crafted the first novel and created a character using what I was experiencing as real life in my book. When you have some real life experience and you know, you've worked in an environment that you're portraying in your novel, you have a sort of an insight really into how you're feeling, what's happening, the logistics of how different units run and that kind of thing. And that adds authenticity to the story. And with that, it makes it more vivid to the person reading it. And I think that's sort of the key of when you're writing something like a medical thriller. What people want is they want real life. They want to be able to relate to it somehow. The more real it is and not made up, the more it validates the experience.
Absolutely. And I definitely feel like real life experiences in the hospital often would feel scarier than anything Hollywood or, you know, an author could create or invent. 'Cause living it is always more difficult for sure. I would love to ask you, despite everything that you've been through and you've witnessed and your experiences in the healthcare system, what still gives you hope about healthcare? Let's talk about the positives.
Oh, and there are tons of positives. I mean, with technology and with AI and with the skills that surgeons are learning now, we have come so far in helping people be treated for chronic diseases. Things like, you know, heart disease used to be huge 20, 30 years ago. And now they can manage so many of the challenges that a sick heart can present. And things like cancer, they've come up with new treatment options. They've come up with new research that shows more effective ways that treat cancer cells as opposed to just chemotherapy. You know, there's gene therapy and there's some other things that are happening. And it's very exciting and it's really improving outcomes for people. So there's tons and tons of positives. I think, you know, research is really important and we need to keep funding research. And I know that's a challenge sometimes, but that's where huge advances in medicine happen, is those researchers asking the what if, and what if we did this, and what if we did that, and what could we try differently? That's where healthcare really is progressive. And every time a new treatment comes out that is effective, that's wonderful. That just means more people are surviving. There's less trauma to the families. And that's what it's all about, is helping people stay well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot more being done around the world in terms of longevity. And so more like preventative stuff. And as we're progressing and with the help of AI, it's actually quite exciting what the healthcare system is going to be able to do and how things are changing and shifting. And so instead of, you know, waiting for symptoms, when symptoms arise, it typically means that the problem's been around for a long time. And so having more devices that can track our everyday stuff and our blood levels, like from moment to moment, that excites me, because we're going to be able to prevent things, hopefully, from progressing and becoming worse. So I don't know, maybe 10 years from now, everyone's lifespan will be longer.
Well, exactly. Well, and, you know, part of it starts right at the beginning of prevention starts right at the get-go, in terms of like eating a healthy diet, being able to afford to eat a healthy diet, having access to food, having access to medicine. So there's so many elements that are involved in health promotion and prevention that, you know, some people think because you don't see a result right away that it's not valuable, but that's truly where health begins, is right at the beginning, in what we put in our bodies, that we exercise, that we get enough sleep, that, you know, we do the things that we were designed to do, as opposed to eating junk food all the time, or takeout all the time, or sedentary lifestyles. So yeah, there's tons that we could educate the public more and make it the norm, as opposed to the few who team to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It definitely starts with the foundational pieces of the sleep and the nutrition. But there's also been those people. I remember a good friend of mine in high school. She was so good. Like, she did not, like, we were kind of bad when we were younger and we liked to go out and party. Not bad, but we enjoyed parties and stuff like that. And she was not involved in any of that stuff. And she came down with some pretty serious health conditions, and it always stuck out to me. I'm like, someone who looks after themselves so much, you know, this stuff can still happen to you. So yeah, there's definitely some deeper stuff at play. Yeah.
You know, and the other thing we need to consider too is how mobile our society is. I mean, let's face it, Ebola, as an example, is a plane ride away. And, you know, we saw with the pandemic that it didn't take much to get things started. And once it started, it just snowballed. And that's where public health really comes into effect, is isolating those people who are ill and understanding that the limitations that were put on us as a world to stop traveling, to stay home, that was the only way they were going to be able to stop that particular superbug. And every bug, virus, bacterial, or whatever, continues to evolve and morph. And with global warming, there's going to be more coming down the road, as things that have been frozen in time for a century are all of a sudden being allowed to be revived. And, you know, I mean, there's so much you could talk about, but that's just one example of things that people think are silly or that disrupt their lives too much or shouldn't be there, but they're there for a very good reason.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's funny you say that. It just brought me to thinking about how I feel when I walk in a hospital, and it's always like, I don't want to touch anything. It always smells so sterile, but I always feel like it's so full of bacteria and bugs. And what is the truth about that? How clean are our hospitals? And is it, I mean, as a nurse, did you find yourself getting sick often
I did at the beginning, and you know, it wasn't because I wasn't doing things properly in terms of washing hands and changing clothes and that kind of thing. It was just because you're exposed, your body is exposed to new things. And for anybody who has small children, you know, those baby germs are deadly, you know, and as a mom, you're constantly getting sick because the kids are getting exposed at school to a variety of different things that you're not used to. So as a nurse, yes, I did get sick. Yes, even with best precautions, sometimes you realize, oh my goodness, I've been exposed to X, Y, and Z, and it may show up on your testing. So that does happen. Now, having gone back to the original question of how clean are hospitals, they try incredibly hard to clean every surface as often as they can. And they have specific protocols and chemicals that they use to do that. And that's great, because if they didn't do that, we'd be in a heck of a lot more trouble than the few times that people do get exposed to things. Nothing is perfect, right? And the bottom line is, you could be carrying a disease and not realize that you're carrying a disease and, you know, go to a restaurant and end up inadvertently sharing whatever you're carrying unbeknownst to you to other people. And that's just the reality of people in small spaces being exposed. It is what it is.
Absolutely. I agree. So what message do you want every listener to remember the next time they or someone they love walks into a hospital?
I think the most proactive thing is to be your own advocate or be the advocate for your family member. You know, if you're really sick, you may not feel up to having that conversation with the doctors, but your family member can. And it's important to not only understand what they're doing and why they're doing it and, you know, accepting what you're hearing, but there's nothing wrong with challenging and saying, are you sure that really is what we need to do? Especially if finances are a challenge and they want to do a bunch of blood work or whatever. Please explain to me why you think we need these tests and how beneficial will they be if I end up having to pay for them. I hate to say it, but in some countries throughout the world, you know, healthcare is very expensive and limited, and you need to understand why you're being asked to have certain tests done.
Yeah, that's great advice. Great advice. Well, thank you so much for being here today and for having this really open conversation about the healthcare system. Please tell everyone more about the work that you're doing and where people can find you and reach out to you.
Yeah, so I have a website for my books. They're medical thrillers, and they are based on my brand, which is Abby Roberts, RN, who works in a variety of settings as each book goes through. It's www.jennywhite.ca. I'm also available for speaking opportunities. What I'm doing is I'm sharing my own journey of reinvention from having a brain tumor to becoming an author and onward. And then coming soon, I'm going to be hosting a TV show with the McCord List out of California. And I will be talking to authors and actors about characters that we have come to love on the screen and on TV and in books. And I'm looking forward to that adventure.
That is so exciting. I'm so excited to hear more and learn more as that develops. And of course, all of the links that you just mentioned, we'll make sure to link in the show notes and any subsequent publications so that people can have really easy access to you and reach out to you. So thanks again for today's conversation. It was so amazing to see you.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And so thank you also to our audience for tuning in. Today's conversation wasn't about fear. It was really about empowerment. So the more we understand how our healthcare system works, the better equipped we are to ask the right questions, advocate for ourselves, support the people we love, and appreciate the incredible professionals who show up every single day under this extraordinary pressure. So Jenny, again, thank you so much for pulling back the curtain for us and sharing not only your decades of experience as a nurse, but also the wisdom you gained after you became the patient. So your story reminds us that knowledge isn't just about power. It can be literally life-saving. If this conversation made you think differently about healthcare, share it with someone you care about. You never know when this information might make all the difference. Take care, everyone. Bye for now.